So I was just talking with Paul in the break about the way it's going back to basics, something that we need to do over and over again, because in a way they're not basics. They're the Dharma. And I tend to find that going back to basics, I kind of learn something new. Are you okay with the sound? Can people hear me? All right. Lovely. Okay. And the Metta Bhavana is one of our basics. It's one of our basic teachings. We teach it at beginners' classes, and we carry on doing it all the way through our Dharma life, basically. Something that Sangharakshita has said is that in a way it can be a complete path to enlightenment, which is something to really take on board, and that's something that's explored in the book Living with Kindness, that, you know, it builds up and culminates with that, you know, that awareness. So going back to basics, the Buddha himself, he taught because he saw that human beings were in a predicament. They had problems. And he had a problem-solving approach. What he saw was that human beings suffer. Human beings are often unhappy in their lives. And what could be done about that? So in a way, when he taught the Four Noble Truths, he's not teaching a sort of metaphysical kind of ultimate truth about existence, that life is suffering. Life is a whole range of things. But the part that's a problem for us is the part that is painful, that's suffering. And he saw in the Four Noble Truths that there's a cause of suffering. In a sense, we find it hard to accept the way things are. We find it hard to accept impermanence. That means that we suffer. And he also saw, he didn't just see in fact, he experienced that there was a release from suffering. And this is quite something. The Buddha is not just talking about an idea. He's talking about his own personal experience, that he broke through into a way of being, a way of seeing, a way of understanding, a way of living, where he felt that he was no longer subject to that suffering. So he talks from experience. And this is why there's this, you know, in a way, all of the Buddha's teaching is motivated by this discrepancy that he felt between his own experience and what he saw in others. And he saw that the suffering that others experienced, he kind of knew that it was possible for that to come to an end. It was possible for us no longer to be subject to that. Yeah. So, in a way, from the earliest of the teachings of the Buddha, what we find is that the emotions are involved right from the beginning and all the way through. There's something that Sangharakshita said, which I think I come back to over and over again. He said, the enlightenment of the Buddha was not a cold, detached knowledge. He saw with warmth. He saw with feeling. What's more, he saw everything as being pure or shubha, which also means beautiful. The Buddha saw everything as pure beauty because he saw everything with compassion. I'm going to read that again later. So this is, you know, in a way, the kind of preamble to metta. Seeing things with metta, seeing things with compassion, means seeing the world differently, experiencing life differently, and experiencing as beautiful. So, I want to just look at the very first chapter in this book is called The Meaning of Metta. And so I'd just like us to maybe kind of brainstorm a bit about, well, can you tell me the meaning of metta? So I'm going to write up your suggestions. Go ahead.
Wishing well.
What?
Wishing well.
Wishing well.
Loving kindness.
Loving kindness.
Interconnectedness.
Open-heartedness.
Unconditional.
Yeah.
Friendliness.
Turning towards.
Compassion.
Did you both say that at the same time? We are one mind.
Radiance.
Empathy.
Boundless. Freedom of heart.
I'm going to stop here because we're running out of space, really.
Love.
Oh, joy.
I can't believe that.
Love. Oh, yes, love.
By the way.
Altruistic. Being love.
I'm going to stop here now. But I don't know about you, but as the words came more, I sort of felt more and more expansive myself.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And it's amazing that one word actually can call up so many other words. In some ways, it's a word that doesn't easily translate in one little, one succinct word. Metta, Maitri in Sanskrit, includes all of those. Ardent goodwill is something that Sangharakshita says. And so, yeah, all of those words are all contained in the word metta. This is, what we're exploring. Just to say the Karaniya Metta Sutta itself begins with the word Karaniya, and that means this is what should be done by one who wants to develop metta. So Karaniya, that's what it means. And then the Sutta means a discourse or a thread or a teaching. Yeah. So The Karaniya Metta Sutta is this what should be done, the discourse on what should be done by someone who wants to develop metta. And I think the way that it's quite succinctly described in the book is a deeply concerned, being deeply concerned for the well-being of another, an enthusiasm for their growth and progress. So it's a sort of real kind of wishing the very best for another. And it's a practical well-wishing that doesn't stay in the realms of just wishing nice things in our mind, but it's, you know, real metta finds expression in action, it finds expression in what we do for one another. Yeah. So, thinking back to the Metta Bhavana itself, I was just thinking how in the early days when we used to teach the Metta Bhavana, we used to teach it in quite a kind of standard way. We would always say the same kind of things, and these were pieces of advice that were based on Buddha Ghosha. Is in fact his advice in cultivating metta. Buddha Ghosha was an 8th century Buddhist teacher and commentator who sort of, what he did was he brought all of the meditation practices that were being practiced at that time into one book, which is about that thick, with very detailed instructions about each one. It's quite lengthy and it's quite hard work to get through. I've certainly never read his book. But nonetheless, if you kind of look at specific bits of it, on his teaching on metta, for example, it has some quite really interesting nuggets that you can really draw out of. But one of the things that Buddha Ghosha was quite specific about who you choose in the Metta Bhavana, and we used to talk about this in the early days. We used to say, don't choose somebody you're sexually attracted to. Don't choose somebody you're either a parent or a child to. Do you remember this? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Don't choose somebody who's died. We sort of stopped doing this because, in a way, it's very easy to give a message then, oh, in that case, that person sitting up the front with the authority, you know, in the kesa, thinks it's bad to have sexual relationships and bad to have families and bad to be attached to our parents. So it's not like that at all. The advice was there in order to kind of give a sense of or a flavour of what metta is and maybe what it isn't. So metta was, well, we would describe it as a really disinterested love, a love that sort of doesn't have a possessive element to it, doesn't have a flavour of self-identification with it. It's in a way a kind of goodwill that's completely for the other, and of course for ourselves. That's not neglecting ourselves. But in talking about metta in terms of, you know, maybe somebody that you feel strongly attracted towards, there's often a kind of wanting something back, feeling insecure around them, that kind of feeling. With children, it's so easy to feel so strongly, I know this myself having had kids, to so strongly identify with their pain and pleasure that it's very, very difficult to separate oneself, you know, and see them as individual human beings with their own lives. You know. So in a way, you know, we don't teach it this way now, but I think it's interesting to look at what does it mean to feel something which is completely for the other, completely, you know, without a kind of self-interest. And I mean, it's not to say that that doesn't happen with friends and other relationships as well. It does, you know. We do feel often there's a kind of reciprocal, you know, if I give this, I'll get that back. Even subtly, you know, if I give praise, I'll get praise back, or somebody will like me, or something like that. So, in a way, this metta contains all of these kind of feelings of warmth and so on, but it's also quite a high ideal to have a sort of wish for the benefit of others, which really doesn't contain self-interest. And I don't think that's actually possible until we have let go of our own self-interest to some degree. It's not even possible. You know. So I don't think it's a case of feeling in any way kind of, I don't know, bad about ourselves, you know, if there is some self-interest involved in our feelings for others. It's just completely and utterly normal, natural and human. But nonetheless, an interesting thing to kind of reflect on, ponder on, be aware of within ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the other aspects of metta which is drawn out in this chapter is that it's a strong emotion. It's a strong feeling. And sometimes it can be seen, I think, as sort of somehow a bit sentimental or wishy-washy, to be kind, you know, sort of like can be seen as not a very intense kind of response to others. In the Pali Canon, what the Buddha says is this, is a quotation. None of the means employed to acquire religious merit, O monks, has a 16th part of the value of loving kindness. Loving kindness, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. So he's saying there that none of the things, none of the practices to acquire religious merit, none of them have a 16th part of the value of loving kindness. That's a very strong statement to make. So what are these other practices? Obviously, meditation and mindfulness. And, I don't know.
Ethics.
Yeah, it's interesting. Ethics and metta. Yeah. That's a whole chapter later on. Ethics. Renunciation. Bodily. I don't know.
Rituals. Giving alms.
Yeah. All of those. None of them have the 16th part of the value of metta. Yeah. It's one of those things that I've heard that reading over and over and over again, and you just stop and think, oh, that's what he's actually saying. Metta is, you know, that powerful. So, and it's interesting that I think in our lives, often the strong emotions are often thought of as the more negative ones. You know, the soap opera emotions. The indignation and the outrage and turbulence and shock and horror. And, you know, all of those. They seem to impact us quite strongly. And it's somehow hard to imagine a positive emotion which is that strong, that passionate, that powerful. You know, sometimes it can be that hard to imagine. Yeah. Yes, this thing that Sangharakshita said, I believe that humanity is basically one. I believe that it's possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being, to feel for any other human being, to be friends with any other human being. This is what I truly and deeply believe. And he goes on to say that this belief is part of him and he would rather die than give it up. Yes, so this is something again to reflect on. How strongly, how powerfully do we, you know, I suppose, believe in our positive emotions and really, you know, see them as, or, well, just experience them that strongly. I think recently I've been reflecting quite a lot on sort of divisions and divisiveness in the world at the moment, which just does seem to be particularly, you know, polarised and so forth. And it's so very easy to have a reaction of outrage against people that you don't agree with. You know, how can they possibly think that? You know, that sort of thing. Strong feelings. And how to kind of find a way of countering those strong feelings, which is equally strong in terms of the positive. How to actually, I suppose, in a way, acknowledge that, first of all, that there's a personal pain involved in that. You know, we feel something is painful, and respond to oneself, one's own pain, but also respond that, you know, that others who you may disagree with also have pain. You know, they may be different. I do think that there's this gesture that in Bante's life that always really moves me, which is when he was going forth as a young man with his friend into homelessness, and they gave away all their money and they burnt their passports. There's something about that gesture that speaks to me of a sort of giving up an identification with any particular group, nationality, you know, whatever. There's a sort of identity, letting go of that kind of identity. I sort of feel I'd love to burn my passport. I can't, but, you know, it wouldn't be practical. But it's something to do with that sense that, you know, humanity is one. And we think of our people and other people, you know. If we looked at the planet from outside, we would just be human people. They're all our people. All of them. Yeah. So, yeah, the metta is something that can be felt with this kind of passionate intensity. And I just remembered something a friend of mine called Kula Prabha once saw sheep drowning in a loch up near Dharnakosha. It was middle of winter, and without a moment's hesitation, just rushed into the loch to try and, you know, save the sheep. It was freezing, you know. Under normal circumstances, nobody would go into an icy loch in the middle of. But seeing the sheep, there was just that immediate response. Unfortunately, it was too late for the sheep. But it is how we respond. You know, those kind of acts of self-sacrifice do happen. You know, we are capable. The third thing to draw out from this chapter is sounds quite different, actually. Metta as the most rational emotion. Might seem, you know, rather contradictory, you know, that it's a strong feeling, but it's also rational. In that, it's the most helpful, reasonable response in any situation. Whatever situation you find yourself in, bringing metta to it is going to help to bring a bigger picture and not a less identification with one side or another point of view, but a sense of the need for all involved to, I suppose, be happy, be satisfied, all involved in that situation. So what metta does is it helps us to kind of disentangle our own personal involvement with wanting something to go one way or wanting other people to see that we're right in a particular way, and see what's the bigger picture, what is going to benefit everyone here in this situation most. And that often, that can mean sometimes we have to let go of certain points of view or, you know, views that we have. But, so in a way, we can only really see things clearly with the eyes of metta. We can only really see things clearly. Yeah. Metta does not discriminate. Okay. Yes, I recently, I was just hearing the life story of the Buddha again. The time when he was sitting, just after his enlightenment, he wasn't too sure if he was going to teach the Dharma because he saw it was going to be a really difficult thing to get across. And it just occurred to me, there he was, he'd seen something. He'd seen something about suffering. He'd seen something about the way people create their own suffering. He'd seen that there was a way not to do that. And at that time, in his own experience, there was nobody else around that saw what he was seeing. And it just made me laugh, because I thought, and he didn't get annoyed with them. He didn't get annoyed with people for not knowing what he knew. I suppose it made me laugh, because that's something I do, you know. If I think, oh, how can they not see what I see? You know, how can they? And it just occurred to me, that wasn't what the Buddha did. If people didn't see what he saw, he communicated with them. And he responded with this kind of metta, with compassion. In all of these situations, he responded in that way, rather than thinking, they're so wrong, you know. So, yeah, the chapter also goes on to talking about metta as wisdom, and there will be more of this later on in the book. But, yes, in a way, we've already sort of looked at this a bit, that if we're letting go of self-interest, then in a way what we're doing is working towards wisdom. And I just want to read the longer version of the quote from Sangharakshita that I read earlier. So this is what he says. The enlightenment of the Buddha was not a cold, detached knowledge. He saw with warmth. He saw with feeling. What is more, he saw everything as being pure, or shubha, which also means beautiful. The Buddha saw everything as pure beauty because he saw everything with compassion, just as, conversely, when you hate someone, they appear ugly. When, out of metta, you see things as beautiful, you naturally experience joy and delight. And out of that joy and delight flow spontaneity, freedom, creativity and energy. This flow from metta to joy to freedom and energy is the constant experience of a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva's wisdom in the fullest sense, therefore, includes metta. In a sense, we could even say that metta is prajna. Prajna meaning wisdom. Metta is prajna. They're the same thing. So, anyway, I've just wanted to introduce some of these themes to you, and now there's an opportunity for you to get into small groups and discuss, you know, if you have questions that have arisen, thoughts that you want to share, comments, and I can... Yeah, I can give you some to kind of get you going, just in case you don't. So we could look at the area of what kind of emotion tends to get our attention most easily. Saying earlier, you know, that idea about being able to experience metta, positive emotions as strongly as we experience negative emotions. So just explore that area. Maybe you could also just reflect on when you have felt genuine, heartfelt wish for the benefit of another. Okay, and so we could look at this area of actually practicing the metta bhavana and what works and goes well for you.
Thank you.